This is How Success Happens, where we talk to polar explorers, war correspondents, founders, ultramarathoners, authors, artists, and a range of other unique personalities to help you understand the capabilities behind how success happens.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
When I'm training for an ultramarathon, anywhere from 100 to 120 miles a week would be in my training cycle. Lots of miles.
You sold something like 250,000 books.
I'm the managing editor at entrepreneur.com and your host, Linda Lacina. Today, we talk to Melinda Richter. Melinda heads up J-Labs, a life sciences incubator powered by Johnson & Johnson that gives entrepreneurs working on everything from pharmaceuticals to medical devices and digital tools the support, equipment, and facilities to get their innovations to market. Melinda isn't a scientist herself, though. She's an MBA who might have had a completely different life if it weren't for a freak bug bite while on a walk in China. That bite got her put in a hospital bed with doctor after doctor saying she might not make it. She'll explain what happened next and how she powered through and how that bite led to an entirely new life, helping entrepreneurs in the health sciences. But first, a word from our sponsor. We'll start with a bit of trivia. In 1677, as I'm sure you all know, England passed something called the Statute of Frauds, which insisted that legal contracts must be in writing and signed. Well, that system then moved over to colonial America, and fast forward 3 centuries, we're all somehow doing the same thing on repeat. But at least there's now a better way to do it, hallelujah. It's called Sign Easy. It's a simple, secure system for your business to digitally sign and distribute documents. You can scan and sign a document, have the system pass that document around to multiple people in whatever sequence you want, track the progress of that document, and even send reminders to the stragglers, the people who still need to put pen to paper, finger to screen. Can you imagine trying to explain this to the Parliament of 1677? Anyway, we today just call it the normal course of business. To get started for free, go to getsigneasy.com/podcast. Hi, Melinda.
Hi, Linda.
So let's get everybody on the same sort of playing field here. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about J-Labs and your role.
Sure. Well, J-Labs is really a concept around trying to get the best innovations to become the best solutions for patients all over the world. So the concept here is that the best science and technology is just as likely to come from outside the walls of a big company like J&J as inside. But when it's out there, faces many more hurdles to actually becoming a viable commercial entity that can get the solutions to patients. So our goal is to take down those hurdles and to ensure that the best science and technology gets to where it needs to be. So we do that through an organization called Johnson & Johnson Innovation. Our goal is to do 3 things. First is to catalyze this innovation community to be focused on the unmet needs out there in health. And we do that through educational programs and networking events and funding series so that we can build an empowered and enabled workforce that's focused on health. And then we give them a platform of resources that mimic the same kind of resources our internal R&D teams have that allow these innovators to focus on the science. So, for example, in now what will be 8 sites around North America, we're going to be opening up in New York City here soon, we have a place where you can go. It's about 30,000, 40,000 square feet. Half that space is all common research space filled with capital equipment that most companies have to go out and raise $3, $4, $5 million in order to have access to. In this case, everybody has access to it when they get in. They also have then individual wet lab, dry lab, and office modules, so you can literally get started as a student coming out of university, have access to a 6-foot bench and have all of that equipment and support resources behind you, but you can literally put it on your credit card like a gym membership, which makes it a lot less risky to start a company in the business of health. And then you have an ops team that takes care of all the day-to-day activities for you so you can focus on the science, what you're really good at, and a business services team that can help you do everything from something as basic but not inconsequential as turn that idea into a company, and then all the other kind of services that help you grow and scale that. So that's the J-Labs model, but we also have our sister teams in our innovation centers and our equity investment partners, JJDC, that work alongside of us and look at the potential of that company to really hit the mark. And if that company has potential in either our pharmaceutical division or medical device or consumer health, then what they can do is say, how do we help that science progress from a deal perspective? And we can do very traditional kinds of deals like equity investments, or we can do licenses or biotech deals. But we can also do very non-traditional, creative, customized deals. So for example, if you have a young team that's working on something revolutionary, and they're excited about it, and we're really excited about it, but nobody really knows for sure, nobody's going to risk big money on them, we can do a small proof of concept study, $100,000, no strings attached. Let's all learn together and see, are we on the right track? Great, let's do a bigger deal, a different kind of deal. If the data is telling us something else, let's revector it into a different unmet need, or it might be the case that they're working on the wrong thing and they should use their time and their talent in some other area. So this model with JLabs, with our deal teams combined together, make it a very powerful end-to-end solution for innovators to focus on the business of health.
Sure, sure. And when we're talking about innovators and the business of health, what are some of the things that these folks are working on?
Well, they're working on things like, for example, we have a company called Arcturus, who just started out as two young guys who had this big dream of making a difference for patients and never thought that they could until the JLabs platform came, and suddenly they felt empowered with their $40,000 to start a company. Yeah. And they're working on hepatitis B, one of the most debilitating, deadliest diseases in the world. And they came to us with $40,000, and in 2.5 years, they became a mid-sized biotech with nearly $2 billion worth of deals, one of them with us on hepatitis B. And when you think about the impact that they could have, you know, hepatitis B has been very challenging because there's so many variants of it that nobody's been able to come up with a solution that hits all the variants. These guys are on the track to doing that. It's really exciting to think about. And then we have device plays, like a company called Intuitap. These guys are in Houston, and what's exciting about them is it started by two young women that were just named 30 under 30 by Forbes last year, and they're working on spinal punctures. It's a very time inefficient, costly, painful process that's not very scientific, actually. And so they're making it scientific so that these lumbar punctures can be, with predictive analytics and imaging, can hit exactly the right mark in the shortest amount of time with the least amount of pain and be the most effective. So that's very exciting. And then we have consumer plays like a company called Zycrobe. Well, they're working on microbiome technology. So we have bugs inside of us. We have bugs on us. And especially on the skin, each of us has our own unique kind of bug landscape, if you will. And we have good bugs and we have bad bugs. And so they're working on a technology that will treat skin inflammation and specific disorders like acne and rosacea and eczema and psoriasis. And literally what they're trying to figure out is how do we figure out what the good bugs are on your skin and then reproduce them and put more good bugs on your skin instead of bad bugs. And so all of these technologies cover the vast spectrum of healthcare. All very different, but all targeted at big unmet needs that are out there in the marketplace. And what's exciting is most of these are really young people. We've got the tried and true entrepreneurs who've been there and done that, and they've had exits, and they're successful, and those are amazing. And we love to have them in the community. And these young people that are so talented and driven and passionate about making a difference, it's amazing what this platform can do for them and therefore do for all of us.
For people who may not really maybe understand how important this is, especially in the health sciences, you know, what impact does this have? I mean, in speeding along them bringing something to market. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. I mean, if you look at our entrepreneurs who are in this model, I mean, really from the perspective of getting money, they can get money. They can go out and recreate their own infrastructure and get access to, materials and equipment and that sort of thing. But In this model, they don't have to spend their time or their money doing that. So they can get started within 24 hours, and they literally tell us that they can do in 8 months what it had taken them 4 years to do before. Sure. Now, consider this in a model in the life sciences where it takes you 8 to 12 years to get a drug to market. So shaving off significant amount of time and money is really important, not just to them doing their work and not having to spend as much time and money and give up as much equity, but for all the patients that are out there waiting. This gives them a significant leap over where we'd been in the past. So that's really exciting. But also then for our young entrepreneurs, many of them don't know what entrepreneurship is. And what we've realized that is entrepreneurship is about having young, passionate, talented people who are working in something really exciting, but maybe don't know what they should be targeting that technology for, what's the big unmet need, and what is industry looking for to prove that it's going to work. And so the big thing is about matching this young talent with experienced wisdom from inside a big company like J&J. People who've been there and done that, have seen things work or not, know what the industry is looking for and can coach and guide these young people to focus their technology on a specific need, and here are the things that industry is going to look to see if you've proven if this is on the right track, and then help them work through work plans, etc., to make sure that they're spending their time and their money wisely, and then bringing in other assistance like regulatory assistance, commercial access assistance, all of that stuff is something these young teams have never been there and done before. So when you've got the talent and the passion, and you marry that with a pretty good formula for how to move it along, you're giving a lot more young people an opportunity to make a difference and to actually make the healthcare system much more advanced, much more productive, much more like how the tech industry is for us. You know, we wake up in the morning and we grab our cell phone and, you know, we're already connected to work and we can see pictures of our family through Instagram, et cetera. And that's so accessible and such a part of our system. We're addicted to it. And so we're hoping that we can get the higher volume and quality of health solutions out there so we become as addicted to our health as we are to our phone.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And you may not have worked on any of this.
Yeah. Right hand turn there. That wasn't expected. That's for sure.
And so you growing up in Canada, right? You know, tell me what you thought you might be doing.
Yeah, that's a very good question. You know, I had not even thought about being really in the healthcare system. That wasn't a business in my mind. I was going to be in a business. I was going to, I wanted to travel the world. And, you know, I wanted to be a part of something that was sexy and cool. And certainly coming out of college, you know, the big thing was getting into the tech industry, as it still is today. So I had no idea I was going to get into the business of health.
Sure. And tell me a little bit about your parents, right? Your dad, you know, was a very interesting.
my parents are both immigrants. So my dad was born around Prague, and he and my grandparents left when he was about 6 years old because they were in World War II and Hitler was coming into town, and they literally left with the shirts on their back and the money in their pocket. And they, you know, came over in a ship to Canada, and they were heading to Vancouver when halfway across the country they realized he had a brain tumor at 6 years old. I think that was 1940. And, you know, they had to stop and get an operation. And, you know, it's amazing that he actually survived that. But by then they had used up all their money. And so they took a homesteading grant. So that's when they were trying to get people to settle in Canada. So they took a plot of land that was way up north in Saskatchewan, along with a bunch of other immigrants. So you get a plot of land and you get some money and you just start working the land. And I remember my dad telling the story about how they only had enough money to either build a house or a granary. So they went for the granary and just sectioned off a corner of the granary for them to live in. So very humble beginnings, and my mom's story isn't different. minus the brain tumor, but same sort of thing, came over from Belarus, Russia, and so they actually ended up growing up in this small community of, I think it grew to a total of maybe 250 people while I was there. So a very different existence, but, you know, we progressed to the time when I was born into a house that had, that was at least a house, but it had no running water, no plumbing, no electricity. Most of my brothers and sisters, I have eight, most of them grew up in that most of their lives. I was fortunate that we eventually got into a house with, you know, real amenities. Still fairly humble, but it was one of those worlds where, you know, my parents had a grade 4 or 5 level education, right? I had no idea what was out there. But what I did have is a father who was very curious about the world, and somebody who believed that, you know, for us growing up, it wasn't Hitler that was the issue. It was everybody who stood around and watched, who didn't take the time to be educated on what was going on in the world, who didn't take the time to debate it and rigorously analyze what was true and what was not.
Yeah.
Kind of analogous to today. And then stand up for people who couldn't stand up for themselves. So he said to us, our job in life was to be educated on what was going on in the world. So we grew up with, you know, the news being on and reading the news and then debating it over the dinner table. And that was just an amazing experience, right? We didn't have very much, but that made it very rich.
Yeah.
And my mom, on the other hand, was taken out of school. She was part of a family of 7 siblings, and she was taken out when she was in grade 4 or 5. Hate to say it, but to essentially be the caretaker of the family. You know, she didn't have very much, but she was so creative, right? My mom, you can put her in a room with nothing and a few little things, and she will figure out how to solve a problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was also an incredible asset for me growing up, to think about how do you take nothing and turn it into something.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we didn't have much, and I didn't really know about school systems, and I was the first one to go to college, but I got some really incredible life skills that I think have helped me along the way.
Sure, sure. And I think what's interesting about that is that when we are growing up, we don't know that maybe what we are living is the same or different from anyone else. You know, it's not until we get older that we have a little bit of a sense of, oh gosh, there's all kinds of different ways to do this, right?
Yes.
Looking back at that, like, what part of that do you think really sort of maybe, like, it was kind of, it gave you a certain DNA or a certain approach to life, you know?
Yeah. You know, it's funny that you say that, because I didn't realize how poor we were until I got to college.
Yeah.
And then you meet all these people and you realize just how different you are. And then, I hate to say it, but there's a part of you that becomes a little bit ashamed, and you pack it away, and you don't want to be seen as different. And I actually didn't really talk about it until one day I had no choice to. That's a long story. But I do think that, you know, those skills that you gain in that kind of circumstance prepare you certainly for entrepreneurship, right? So you don't have very much, so you have to be really creative about what you're going to do and have an imagination about it, and you have to be very industrious. You don't get stuck on, well, I don't have that, so I can't do this. You figure out how to make it happen even though you don't have very many resources. And you have to work hard, right? It's pure grit. And no matter how bad things get, you have to figure out how to pick yourself up and dust yourself off and laugh about it and move on. And certainly, because I had 8 brothers and sisters, one of the things that made it very special for me was seeing how great each one of them was, even though they were very different. And it was one of those things, I don't know where I picked that up, but I really celebrated what talent or strength each one brought to the table. And I would not leverage it, but I appreciated it. And then I would go to them for advice or wisdom. And so if I look at all of that, I'd say I gained curiosity from my dad, creativity from my mom, industriousness and grit from both of them to, you know, survive, a sense of humor from being in a large family who you're always teasing each other and telling each other not to whine or cry. but then utilizing the community of people around you to make them better, make you better, because it takes a village. And I think that's what's really special about J-Labs is it's a community.
Yeah.
It's a movement. It's not me. It's all of us together. When I look at we just did an impact report. In our stats, we show that 23% of our CEOs are women.
Yeah.
18% compared to the industry average of 1%. 18% are minorities compared to industry average of 8%. Well, that doesn't happen by itself. So how can we help each other? And if we help each other, we're going to be better for it. We're going to be stronger for it. And we're going to reach the patients. And that's what we really care about. Yeah. So all of that, my background, helped build what J-Labs is today.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think it also helps, to sort of build on what you're saying, it helps model a different way of problem solving. It's one thing to sort of say, oh, just talk to people, teamwork, you go further with others, right? Everyone says these things. But often when we have a problem, sometimes we just hunker down and try to solve it ourselves. And there's a lot of isolation in entrepreneurship.
You know, one of our companies had this great stat quote that we put into the impact report, which I thought said it all, which is we're surrounded by a community of diverse intellects that on our own, we would be not just isolated, but insufficient. But together, we can have these different perspectives to solve problems at the time when they happen, not sit there and fret and, wonder how can I do it and then try to figure out who to talk to. You're bumping into people all the time that have different backgrounds and skill sets and knowledge bases, and you can solve problems very quickly. And not just solve problems, but think about brand new solutions you wouldn't have thought about otherwise.
And so let's go to that sort of pivotal point when you've graduated from school, you're working, right? You've got all of this all of these experiences that have sort of made you the young woman that is taking on the world, right?
Yeah.
You're at a special conference in Beijing, right?
Yeah.
And then what happens?
Oh, well, I'm in a special conference in Beijing, and you're right. I feel like I'm on top of the world. I'm with this telecom company. I was accepted. You know, me, the poor kid from the sticks, got accepted into this leadership development program with a leading telecoms company. And, you know, they're flying me all over the world to, you know, experience different roles and different geographies with different business units. And there I am in Beijing, and I'm actually about to jet off to my next assignment. And then I'm walking through the woods and I get bit by a bug. And within 24 hours, I land in the International Health Clinic. And by the way, just getting to an International Health Clinic back then in the 90s in Beijing was not an easy task when you're sick. I'll never forget that moment when the doctor walks in and says, you know, I'm sorry, but there's nothing more we can do for you. You should call your family. And, it's a very sobering moment. It's, you gotta deal with the fact that you're only, mid-20s. You haven't done a lot of the things that other people have done, that you always imagined you would do. And then life gets very simple. And you realize it's kind of what they say, you come into this world alone and you die alone. And suddenly you feel, very vulnerable, very naked, very helpless. And all this money that you thought was so important, particularly because you grow up poor, really doesn't matter. It's not going to help you. And so in that moment, when they tell you there's nothing more they can do for you, you just hope that somebody out there is fighting for you.
Yeah.
And you don't know their names and you can't see their faces, but you hope that they're out there. And, obviously I was lucky and I made it. It was a bit of a journey to get there. But it made me realize that if I was able to make it, that I needed to have my life be about not just changing my story, but changing many people's stories in a way that was personal to me. And being a part of this healthcare system, which was so archaic and so behind compared to what we were doing in the tech industry. Back then, we were trying to figure out how to order a soda from the vending machine with our cell phones, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And in that moment, that seems pretty darn frivolous.
Yeah.
And you wonder how all this money and press and talent, how could you be spending all this time on that when some pretty basic human healthcare gaps existed out there? And so I realized that I needed to be a part of making that story different, about making it just as productive, as sexy, as great of an industry to be in for the top talent and the top investors to want to be a part of as the tech industry. And, you know, it took me a while to recover, and I took some time to go do my MBA before transitioning over, but it changed my life,
yeah.
Completely changed my life. And the people at my company thought I was crazy. They were like, you're going to the top. What are you doing? They got me a therapist, because they're like, you've just been through a traumatic time, which is probably true. I mean, post-traumatic stress probably played a huge factor in that, but I was so compelled. It wasn't even a question in my mind. It was really about how do you make it happen? And I never knew what I was going to make it into. I just knew I needed to get started. And that's kind of it, you know, in entrepreneurship, you just gotta get started.
Yeah, yeah. And you know you need to make a change, and you know that you've sort of simplified life to just a handful of ideas. You know, what is the thing that drives you then to, you know, get an MBA? You know what I mean? Like, what is the thing in your head that's saying, okay, this is my next step. My footfall goes here.
Yeah. You know, well, that was it was a challenging time because I was still trying to process the whole experience, and I knew I needed to make a shift to, you know, get out of one thing and learn about the other and give myself time to reflect on how to do that. And the MBA was kind of a step out and a reflective time for me.
Yeah.
And then that was a way for me to then say, where should I be to do this? Obviously, the Bay Area is, you know, the home of biotech. And if you're going to start something, it was a great place to think about starting something. And I had some really good friends that were there. And I just started off by learning, right? Meeting and working with entrepreneurs in the life sciences and starting to ask all those stupid questions that people who are in the industry don't ask because, you know, they're PhDs, and this is the way it's always done, and why would I ask that question? Whereas I could come at it from a completely orthogonal point of view and say, well, why do you do that? And what is necessary about this? And then start to kind of plot, you know, against analogs like the tech industry. So this is where I came to that sort of aha moment where you go, let's see, in the tech industry, you can give a couple of guys a couple computers and a couple $100,000, and a couple years later, they can turn around and sell that to Microsoft or Yahoo or Google for $200 million, right? Fast and easy, just like that. In the life science industry, before you even turn the lights on, you're spending millions of dollars, at least a year, if not more, getting capital, enough capital, millions of dollars, to get your infrastructure, your capital equipment, your permits, your license, your operating team, and then you still need, 8 to 12 years to get a drug to market and billions of dollars. So, you know, looking from the outside in, who in their right mind would ever start a life science company? You know, it takes so much money, so much time. You get so diluted that by the time you actually get something to market, if you ever do, you're so diluted. You know, the only thing you're making is a difference, and that's not sustainable over time as an industry. And so I knew that was a problem we needed to solve. We needed to make it faster and easier and cheaper to start a life science company so that entrepreneurs wanted to get into it because they could actually make some money doing it and they could actually see an outcome, and investors could get a real return. And then I went back to what I had learned by going through this program with Nortel. You know, I had a series of assignments where you'd have about a year to get something up and running, a project or a product. And I could do it that fast because every place I landed, there was infrastructure, there was equipment, there was an ops team, there was legal teams, there was marketing teams, and all I had to do was focus on my project.
Yeah.
And so therefore, I could get it done in a pretty short period of time. So then my analog was, well, why can't I create that same sort of infrastructure, that same sort of program for early stage life science companies where it has everything they need, that each one would individually have to go out and do the same thing over and over again. So that's not very time or capital efficient, but you create one kind of platform that they could all come in on the one end and shoot out on the other end, being a much more advanced technology, taking far less time and money, less risky for all of them. And then maybe we could increase the volume and quality of things coming out. Now, then add on top of it, kind of wisdom coming from industry partners, whether it's within J&J or, you know, partners outside of J&J to say, okay, you've got this great idea, but here's all the things that the industry needs, or here's how it works, here's where things go wrong, here are the watch outs. Let's help you plot it out. And then you've got a solution on steroids. So for me, you know, I guess everything happens for a reason. Maybe I needed to go through one experience, you know, of being in the tech industry to be able to provide a completely different way of working in life science innovation.
Yeah. And when you went to Silicon Valley, that was a shift, right? Because you had to kind of restart. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It was a restart. You know, in the tech industry, you know, I was one of 5 to 8 people recruited onto this program around the world, right? So, you know, you're treated pretty well. It's like you're being chauffeured around the world to each assignment, and you can get used to that pretty quickly. And I had built up some money, and I had a comfortable life for myself, and then you start over. Yeah. And you go work for yourself, and you pick up the phone, and nobody knows your name. You aren't calling from a big name company anymore. Who's going to listen to you? And then you start selling everything little bit by little bit to fund what you're doing. And at first, you're like, okay, well, I'm just going to downsize to a studio apartment. And then it's like, well, maybe I don't need my car. I can have a bike. And then maybe I don't need a bike. I can sell that, and I can take the bus. And oh, it's very humbling. And yet, I was so compelled that. I loved the learning journey that I was on. It was hard, but I didn't feel like it was burdensome. It felt like it was part of that journey. And, you know, then over time, you just, you know, you make strides, you make steps, you make little accomplishments, you hit milestones, and then you finally get back to a place where you can feel like you have a little bit of it all, like where you were before. And you feel like you're really making a difference. And that's been, it's been really rewarding.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about that process is you're releasing these things, but they're things that you know that you can get back again, and they're not as important as the thing you're building.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, you know, for me, that it still was a sensitivity for me because I grew up so poor and... you know, every decision we had in life was first couched with the question of how much does it cost?
Sure.
And so there was, you know, there was always been and still always a little bit of anxiety for me about being poor because it's just, you know, there's a lot of people who I see kind of, how would you say, adulate, you know, being poor, kind of being that in that hippie mode, and I get it. And yet a part of me goes, you have no idea what it's like to be that poor and have to make those trade-offs and those decisions.
Yeah.
And so, but you do know you can get it back. And that was, I think that was the kind of the moment when I was able to relinquish it was when I was told I wasn't going to make it, right? And I had this picture of myself lying on a bed of money, and it made no difference. It was just a bed of money. There's nothing I could do with it. And that's when you let go of all of those things that say, oh, I can't be poor anymore. I need money. When it comes to that moment, it really absolutely does nothing for you. And so, yes, you can let go of it, and you can get it back, and then you can redeploy it in different ways. And actually, that's what I think is exciting about what we're doing in the life science industry. In the tech industry, I told you, a couple of guys, a couple of computers, a couple hundred thousand dollars, you know, then they walk away with so much wealth. There are so many billionaires in the tech industry. How many billionaires do you think are in the life science industry?
Probably not. I don't know, but not very many, I'm guessing.
I think we hit our third one recently. And that's because people get so diluted. So it's very hard for that kind of exponential effect to happen in the life sciences and the tech industry. All those entrepreneurs come back and they either start more companies or they fund other companies. And so just happens. The snowball effect happens. It doesn't happen necessarily in life sciences, but now it's starting to, because now people are able to get further along without having to give away equity. And that's why it was really important for us to have a no strings attached model. So when companies come in, they don't give anything to us. They pay for their play, whatever kind of space they need. It's all, you know, price per component of space, let's say. They just pay a fee for it, and they don't give up any equity, any value, because really, this is a difficult time. We just want them to have an opportunity to prove it out, and we get an opportunity to work with them along the way and have a better idea of the team and technology, and then when it's right for them and right for us, then we do a deal. And that's changing the value structure in the life science industry. And so now one of my, you know, I have all these little proud moments. And one of them was one of my first companies. It was at JLabs in South San Francisco. I saw them in the conference room. I was walking by, I waved. I said, "What are you guys doing here?" And they said, "Well, you know, they sold their company to Roche for, I think it was a few hundred million dollars." And they're like, "Well, we're back. We're investing in companies. So we're looking at what you got around here and seeing if we can put some money in." I'm like, "Yes." Yeah. That's exactly right. In fact, one of our CEOs in San Diego, Todd Harris, had a company called Sienna, and he was one of these classic, really bright young men. He graduated from MIT, went to work for McKinsey for 4 years, but wanted a different lifestyle and wanted to make something, like wanted to make a difference. And so he quit his job. He had enough money, enough savings to get a bench, pay a monthly rate, like a gym membership at JLabs, and tried out a proof of concept within a year, raised $34 million, this young kid, and he had long blonde hair, total like surfer dude. Really funny to see him in the lab and talking to our board of directors came, and they loved what he was working on and what he did. And he just IPO'd his company last year. Okay. It's incredible. And over very little investment from him, and now he's investing in his next company and bringing it back into JLabs. That's how it happens. And this happened in a like 3-year period of time, 4-year period. It's remarkable in life sciences. And so that's what's going to help drive it forward. And I don't think people understand until they get sick just how slow our industry is to progress.
Yeah, yeah. What surprised you in sort of like when you, in the very beginning, when you were sort of putting this model together for the health sciences, you know, about maybe how you needed to adapt it from tech, you know, like there's still some differences that need to be made, and you learn by, you know, just by clashing into it, you know.
Yeah.
So what sort of surprised you?
So I think what surprised me the most was just how kind of simple some of the problems were. And that if you worked through how it takes to get a company off the ground, that you could see some patterns. And for me, they were pretty simple patterns, but clearly nobody had seen that before. I think that's always the case. When you see something and they create a company, you're like, "Oh, so simple, I should have thought of that." And it was kind of that. And that if you could just, you know, one by one, step by step, kind of look at all of these different parts of the problem, that you could create a solution. And what was interesting to me is that some people, when I first got started and I pitched the idea, came at me with the typical, there, you're crazy, this is never going to work. And by the way, Melinda, everybody in this industry has a PhD. Even the janitors at Genentech have a PhD. So there. Please go away. But if you hit the right people and you presented a well thought out, here's a solution, here's how it could work, here are the issues, here we're going to address them, what do you think? You know, people like the folks at J&J said, "Yeah, I think that's I think that's workable. And let's put our respective assets together. You know, you're an entrepreneur. You know, you've got an entrepreneurial model. We've got the largest global healthcare company in the world. So we've got span and reach and assets we can bring to the table. If we put this together, maybe we could make a difference in the industry. And so that was what was surprising to me, just that openness. And that's what I've really enjoyed about Johnson & Johnson. Listen, I wasn't actually looking for, a big partner to become a part of. I certainly wanted to work with big partners, but I didn't ever see myself going back to being in a big company. When you experience being a CEO of your own company, you can make decisions quickly and get things done. You're like, hell no. But they had a group of people, especially the leaders at the top, who are very passionate about patient solutions, who had been physicians on the front lines of AIDS in Africa, and who had been entrepreneurs and gone through that, you know, cycle where you're running out of money and you don't know if you're going to be able to survive the week and make payroll. Sure. And it's when you have people like that who've experienced that, you come from decisions with a very different value base. And like I said, whenever I hear our chief science officer speak, I hear the voice of the patient, right? He's, you know, one of the reasons he got into biotech from being a physician is that his good friend got HIV and didn't think he was going to live, and he had a four-year-old daughter, and he wanted to make sure that he got to see his granddaughter. And so that's how he got into, I can't just treat it, I have to figure out how to cure it or manage it. And he was a huge part of that. And now his friend's daughter has a four-year-old daughter, right? Yeah. And if you're driven by something that's very mission-based, very values-based, well, then you're willing to buck the system. You're willing to take chances. You're willing to do experiments. And that's what I think has been great about J&J. They're willing to try experiments, and that's what you need. You need that risk-taking culture. Now, that doesn't mean we're being entrepreneurial on the inside and, you know, selling and ducking and weaving and making the process work for you, as opposed to necessarily following the process. But that's what's been surprising to me, just that ability for a big company to actually take risk and be nimble.
Yeah. As you were building out the model in the beginning before J&J was in the picture, was there a moment where you thought to yourself, maybe I can't pull this together? Like, maybe this isn't coming together. You know, like, what? Like,
yeah.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I do this talk. I did it originally, a TEDx video, and then and I've done a series of these talks, like The Power of Why. Why do you do it? And how does it keep you going? And you know, when I do my talk, you know, in 20 minutes and 20 slides, it can look like an incredible story. And it's very successful. And you don't see all the hills and the valleys that have happened over that time. And there were many times when I was ready to give up. Yeah. It was hard. And there were a lot of whiskey and tears along the way.
Sure.
But then you go back, or I shouldn't say you.
Definitely.
I will say me. Then I go back to that night.
Yeah.
In that hospital room where I was hoping that somebody was out there and fighting for me. And then I pick myself up and I dust myself off and I get back to work. And it's a very grounding place to go back to, and I don't like going back there because it still can be very overwhelming. But it, it makes that problem seem in perspective, not that bad. And that there are still a lot of people out there who are counting on us to keep fighting. Yeah. And this is a hard industry. You know, it's not uncommon to see a drug go all the way to phase 3 and fail. Yeah. Go in front of the FDA for approval and it's declined. And the amount of money and time that's gone into that. There's many people who've never seen a drug get to market and they've worked on it all their lives. And listen, these are really smart people who spent a lot of money going to some prestigious schools who actually don't make that great of salaries in the life science industry, but they're there because they want to make a difference, and they give up a lot for that. And so it's tough. It's tough to go through all that and at the end of the day have your drug pulled or fail. And so, you know, I think it's a testimony to what we're all doing here, which is believing in something that's bigger than ourselves. And you just have to go out there and get connected with patients again. You know, we do this thing once a quarter where we bring in a patient and have them tell their story. You know, brings us all right back home. We get back in the labs, we get back in our offices. And you know what? We can deal with all of those challenges then when we know what we're fighting for.
Yeah, yeah. What trait do you think helps you sort of push through this and find those solutions and what helps you, do you think?
You know, I think it's that, I think it's those qualities my parents instilled in us growing up, which is, you know, seeing what the situation is and not letting that define you or get stuck by it or be a victim of it. I don't believe in being a victim of things. I still see people come into J&J and they get frustrated. They're like, I can't get anything done here. I keep getting told no. I'm like, I get told no all the time. My first question back is, tell me more about your no. And yes. Once you break it down, there's probably about 9 of the 10 things there that are easily solvable or a communication issue, whatever. And then there's one that's not, and then you figure out a way around it. I've been told no a lot at J&J. I'm famous for saying, uh-huh, okay, see you later. I'll be back. And that's what it takes, right? Don't let that situation define you. Don't let those obstacles be your no. But then say, how do I rise above it? And how do I look at the situation and figure out another creative solution and then work it? And you got to work it, you know? Nobody's going to hand anything to you. You got to work the system. You got to duck and weave, and you got to bring lots of people in. There's a lot of people at J&J who don't work directly for me or with me, and yet I feel like I have an army of people out there that are all very passionate about making J-Labs and all these innovation plays work because they want to be a part of something that's bigger. And if you can create a community for them and a story that is meaningful, it's amazing what you can get done. And that is, I think, because of how I grew up.
Yeah. I think another aspect of this that is really compelling and really essential for people to remember is sort of the long path to getting something done, right? So it's easy for anyone, like you were talking about, you know, okay, 20 slides, 20 things, right? So that, oh, I had this experience, and then I had this idea, and then poof, it's all fixed, right? There's not...
It's not that at all. No, it's a journey.
Yeah, it's a journey.
It's a journey, and if you're expecting instant gratification, it's not the place, right? You know, sometimes it happens. Sometimes you can get that instant gratification. It's very rare. And certainly if you're making systemic change, that takes a lot longer. I'll never forget, I was reading about Twitter about how the CEO said, oh, yeah, sure. Everybody says we were an overnight success. We've just been working at this for 14 years, and it finally clicked, right? And people don't see that. They want to be a part of that instant gratification. I get it. I'd love that, too. But that's not really how change happens, not generally speaking anyway. And so that's why you have to be there for the right reason, right? You have to understand your why. And I say this all the time in one of my talks, which is, you know, investors, when I first started getting into the industry, and I say to investors, like, how do you know which is the right play? And I said, what is it? Is that entrepreneurs' experience? Is it their skills? Is it their technology they're working for and working on? And they're like, oh, yeah, sure, all of that is an important part. But the key is the willingness of that entrepreneur to walk through walls.
Yeah.
That's the term, actually, is a walk through walls, because the road to doing something new is always paved with hurdles like disappointments and setbacks and sacrifices. And the only way you can get through all of those to hit the finish line is if you're compelled by a powerful why. Why are you there? Why are you doing this? And, you know, I think everybody wants to be working on their why. Like, they want to do something that's meaningful to them. And I think this, I think it would be the saddest thing in the world to die and not feel like you have been working on something meaningful or have made a difference in some way. And it doesn't have to be big. It can be something small. But understanding your why, that's what gets you through all those tough times, to be compelled by what you want to accomplish. And I think that's what makes us a successful entrepreneur.
Yeah. Well, and I think that maybe it's a better question to ask yourself when something is not, you know, going right. Right. It's not I have to have the answer for what to do right now and be able to sort of draw out my path for the next 10 years. Right. That I just need to understand why am I doing this, and maybe draw some kind of strength or support from that.
Yes. Absolutely. And take it one little step at a time. You know, I didn't imagine everything that I was going to turn, J-Labs into. I started with one small step, one small question, and then solve for that question, and then the next one, and the next one. And suddenly you develop a model. And I think many people get stuck by like, oh, I don't have this big answer, and I need this big thing that I need to work on. And really it's about what are you passionate about? Kind of difference you want to make, and then start with one small thing or one small project or one small question, and it'll lead somewhere if you're curious. And if you're willing to go through all of the no's and the hurdles and the obstacles on the way there. But the most important thing is then why. Why are you doing that that will take you all the way through that?
Yeah, understanding your why.
Mm-hmm.
No, I love that. I love that. Well, Melinda, we'll have to leave it there. We've had a wonderful chat. I think this is wonderful. Thank you so much for all your insights.
Oh, thank you, Linda, for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And for those listening to listen to more podcasts from this series, find us on iTunes, Stitcher, and follow us on SoundCloud. Mm-hmm.